Welcome to Wealthion. Wealthion founder Adam Taggart here, welcoming you back for another weekly market recap featuring our market guru, Lance Roberts. Hey, Lance, how you doing, buddy?
I'm fine. I'm surviving the week.
Good. I know it was another busy week. I don't think it was as crazy as the previous two, but it certainly still had some of its ups and downs. What is your theme of the week?
Theme of the week for the markets is that, you know, we should expect a bit of a reflexive rally here to some degree. Markets are very oversold, very negative. And there's a lot of reasons. And we saw some fits and starts of that this week where any bit of good news really leads to an outsized rally. And that rally should be used for reducing risk, rebalancing portfolios, you know, those type of things. We broke some important technical supports this week. That's going to potentially put some more downward pressure on markets over the next week. We've got the Federal Reserve next week as well. So I think once we get past the Federal Reserve, and if they can kind of thread the needle with a little bit of dovishness, I think we're set up here for at least a fairly decent, you know, 5-7% rally that we'll want to fade that rally into.
Okay, great. So theme of the week, rebound. Right. Be ready for prices to recover here, especially if there's, you know, any good news that sticks.
Yeah, that's the key, Adam. We got to have some good news. I don't know what it is, but we need to actually have some, because right now we just have an abundance of bad news.
All right. And that's probably worth just sticking on for one second here is for the past bunch of years, the markets have always been able to find some positive story to use as the next reason to leg up. Mm-hmm. But since the beginning of the year, and certainly since the outbreak of the war in Ukraine, it really hasn't been much good news at all for the market to hang its head on. So, I think you could just say it's starved of good news. And the second it sees some, it's just going to explode. Well, kind of like a seed in a desert, just waiting for that first drop of rain. Right. So
no, it's true. But, you know, there's a difference, though, this time. You know, every time in the past, and you're absolutely right, for the last few years, in particular, last 3, 4, 5 years in particular, it didn't matter what the news was, trade war with China, or, you know, it's the Trump administration, or, you know, whatever it was, right? I mean, there was always kind of negative headlines, and the markets just kind of ground higher. And there was a reason was because you had basically no inflation and you had a Federal Reserve that was being very accommodative. Now we're going into a Fed hiking cycle, and there's no doubt they're going to hike rates. There's QE, by the way, QE ended on Wednesday. There is no more QE now. So what that means is it doesn't mean the Fed is not buying bonds. They are, but they're only buying bonds as they mature. So basically, they're keeping the balance sheet flat. And this is what we saw back in 2017 heading into 2018. If they begin to roll off that balance sheet in terms of reducing it, that's an additional tightening to the markets. But nonetheless, there isn't that liquidity from QE coming in. The Fed is going to hike rates on Wednesday, and you now have the highest inflation in 40 years. This is an environment that stocks have not seen before. And all those mantras that we've had over the last 5 years in particular, low interest rates justify high valuations, low inflation justifies high valuations, all those reasons the bulls were coming up with to buy stocks no longer exists. So this is the real challenge. You still have, you know, valuations trading at 35, 36, 37 times earnings. And those earnings are starting to drop rapidly now. The Atlanta Fed has, as we talked about last week, the Atlanta Fed is now at John Belushi's GPA of zero as of March. But now even Goldman Sachs, who was very bullish on economic growth this year, we weren't. You know, last year we were writing articles about the reversal of the liquidity and why we would have below trend economic growth this year. Goldman Sachs caught up with us today and said, hey, 1.75% for GDP this year. And I think they're still too high. So that's going to lead to a very big contraction in earnings. And that's going to cause forward valuations to go up. And that's going to be even a bigger problem for bulls as we go forward. So it's not really a function that this time is different. I don't want to say that, but what is different is we have some variables we haven't dealt with before.
All right. Well, all that is a great segue into the next point I want to talk about with you, which is what we were chatting about before we turned the camera on here, which is we did get you know, an initial whiff of good news. I think it was Wednesday, and markets just went off to the races. Right. I mean, the S&P was up several percent instantly. You know, that then sort of trickled back down the next, we could have lost it all the next day as people realized that that good news didn't stick. But you know, that gave enough time for those articles to come out and saying, hey, this is why you've got to be invested in the markets, because, you know, when you miss those big up days, you really lose out on a lot of the long-term appreciation of your portfolio. I know you're working on a newsletter for tomorrow where you say, yeah, it's not wrong, but it's much more important to avoid the bad days than it is to put yourself at risk to get the good days. Can you just elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and it's true. On Wednesday, as an example, the S&P was up almost 3%. The NASDAQ was up over 3%. And the headlines came out the next day is like, this is the biggest day of the year, you know, and immediately people were going, well, you know, if you weren't in the markets, you miss out on the biggest day, you know, the best days of the year, the 10 best days of the year. If you miss those days, then you give up half of your potential capital gains over the long period of time. And that's true. But what they're not telling you is that if you miss the 10 worst days of the year, you improve your capital gains over the long term by 2.5 times. So just avoiding the drawdowns over the long term, you know, makes this a much more important cycle. Now, everybody goes, well, you can't time the market. And look, I agree with you. You can't be all in, you can't be all out of the market. But here's the thing about the 10 best days of the market. When do the 10 best days of the market occur? Generally, right around the time you have the 10 worst days of the markets. In fact, if you go back historically and look, the majority of the best days of any given trading year occur during, you know, especially the biggest best days over the course of over a period of time occur during bear markets. And that's not surprising. We saw huge rallies in March of 2020 that were following huge declines. So, you know, yeah, if you miss those days, it certainly hurts you, but you know, you would have been better off just missing the decline altogether and then getting back into the market at some point. And this is why managing risk and managing money is so important over time. It's avoiding the drawdowns. If we just spend a bunch of time getting back, and this is just logic, by the way, if we spend a bunch of time getting back to even, we're not making money. And if our goal is to make 6% a year, and this is the big pension fund problem, you know, pension funds rely on 7% annual returns a year to make sure they've got enough money to feed their pensionees. That's great. The problem is that if you have 1 year where you have a zero rate of return, you're now 7% behind your mark. The next year, you've got to make 14%, really 15% to catch up on the year that you lost of 7%. And so that compounding effect that everybody talks about is like, oh, well, you got to be in the market. You got to compound returns. Any year that you lose money, you completely invalidate the whole theory of compounding, because now you've got to make up those losses, which are also compounding with you over time. And this is why, look, after the two biggest bull markets in history, 80% of Americans don't have any money in the bank. Investing doesn't work the way that the media tells you. The way investing works over time is protecting capital and growing it when you have an opportunity, but growing it safely.
Perfect. Lance, you're just sort of reiterating all the reasons why we picked you to be our expert here on the weekly market recap. Super well articulated. And just to recap real quickly, you said, hey, these best days in the market, you know, that we see historically, a lot of them, as you said, are coming during bear markets. So these are what you call a bear market rally, where you sort of think of like a ball bouncing down a stairway, right? It bounces down a couple steps, hits one, bounces up a little bit, but then keeps on going down further, right?
Right.
I know that you also were explaining to me, and I thought this was a really great analogy, that these kind of bear market stair steps, they're very much like that scene in the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, The Revenant. Mm-hmm. Do you want to describe for people that analogy?
Well, I'll describe the analogy, but I hope you'll have to put the link to the video, you know, down in the comments.
We'll put it down in the comments in the description. Yeah.
And the reason is that you have to see the scene. And when I first saw this movie was out in 2015, by the way, And when I saw this scene, I had to really sit back for a minute and I go, this is exactly why we call bear markets bear markets. And, you know, we have these names, right? It's a bull market, it's a bear market, but nobody ever asks why we have these names. And, you know, bear markets are mauling events, right? They're fast, they're vicious, and they basically just destroy you very quickly. And this scene of Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant, he's out in the woods hunting, and he turns around and this bear attacks him. And the bear's flopping him around, just mauling him, just tearing him up. It's a graphic scene. Let me warn you right up front.
Yeah, let's warn folks. It is pretty darn graphic.
and the fact that they made this movie is pretty amazing. But in the middle of the attack, the bear leaves, and you think, oh my gosh, it's over, right? And there's this reprieve, and he's sitting there, and he's about to come back around again. And all of a sudden the bear comes back and just all over him again. It's even a more vicious attack the second time around. And that's, and as I was looking at this, I go, this is Bob Farrell's analogy of bear markets. The bear markets, also Dow Theory, by the way, if you subscribe to Dow Theory, it's exactly the same analysis, which is bear markets have three phases. They have this initial hit. Then you have this reflexive rally, the reprieve, so to speak. And this is where everybody goes, oh, thank goodness it's over. And in the financial markets, we have the initial decline. You have the rally. And this is where Jim Cramer comes out on CNBC and says, see, told you, just a correction. It's all over. Everybody back in the pool. And investors go running back in just in time for the bear to come back and just maul the rest of you, you know, down into oblivion. And that's the way bear markets work. It's this initial decline, this reflexive rally, and then the real mauling occurs. And that's where, if you go back to 2008 as a good example of this, you had a decline early in 2008. You had this reprieve rally that came back and retested the bottom of this head and shoulders pattern. Then we started going lower again, and then Lehman hit. And then that was where a big chunk, about 40% of the entire decline occurred just between Lehman and the end of the year. So that's that type of environment that bear markets exist in. Now, why is this important now? And the reason I'm saying this is because right now we have very negative sentiment. And, you know, I'm sitting there going, hey, be careful here, because it's, you know, being very negative right now and being, you know, very hedged against risk and all that's fine. But there's a point to where this market is going to bounce back. It's just a function of how markets work. You are going to get a fairly strong reflexive rally. And that reflexive rally is going to be just strong enough to get you to start reducing your risk, getting rid of your hedges, getting back on the longer side of the market. You know, you'll be kind of losing money now, and all those hedges you put on earlier this year. And so you'll be closing those out just in time for the bear to come back and finish mauling the rest of you. So that's just the way this market's going to work. And you need to be aware of this cycle that we're in, because we just broke the head and shoulders pattern that was building in the markets. We retested the bottom of that neckline on Wednesday and failed on Thursday and Friday. If we don't get back above that neckline next week, that will be a confirmed break. And we should expect a retest of the recent lows where Russia actually invaded the Ukraine. That's 138% retracement from the peak. And below that, we're going to start getting a lot more negative very quickly in markets. So there's some real risk here to the downside if the Fed comes out next week and is extremely hawkish. Say they go ahead and hike 50 basis points or something much more negative occurs in Russia, there is risk to the markets that you need to be aware of.
All right. So as we look and watch what happens next, Lance, it sounds like you're saying, given oversold indicators, mm-hmm. you know, the data that you look at, you are thinking it's more likely here that we're going to get some sort of bounce in the relatively near future, especially if there's some good news, especially on the war front. And if we don't, then you're saying, hey, folks, we should really be very cognizant. There could be a real waterfall cascade coming, because technically, you know, we failed the retest and there's a lot of empty space below.
Yep.
If we do get a bounce, are there indicators you're going to watch to tell you whether it is indeed that, you know, relief rally that's then going to roll over and be the second mauling by the bear versus, you know, I don't know if you put a lot of potential on this, but it could be the bottom and we could go back up to new highs again. So what will you be watching to try to get a sense for which one it's going to be?
So there's a couple of very, you know, the interesting thing about the market right now is it's given us a very clearly defined pathway. And we kind of talked about this last week as well, is that, you know, if you look at the markets right now, we have a very defined downtrend from the January highs. Above that downtrend line, we then have the 50-day moving average. Above the 50-day moving average, there's really no resistance until you get back to all-time highs. If you break above all-time highs, then you're back in the bull market. So this is now this is really critical. We are not out of this problem with the markets until the markets break out to all-time highs, right? So literally, we could have a market rally that would take us back to all-time highs, fail, and then take us right back down to lows. And that wouldn't negate this bear market pattern that we're building right now. So there's a lot of overhead right now that we've got to work with before we can sit back and say, oh, thank goodness we're out of the woods. Now, if we get above the 50-day moving average, then that's going to be a more bullish, optimistic sign. We'll want to give that a little bit of credibility. Say, okay, we've gotten back above the 50-day moving average. We're probably going to go back to retest highs. But, you know, that's going to be a very difficult challenge. We've got another problem that's coming. And very soon, if this market doesn't really get it together, the 50-day is going to cross below the 200-day moving average. And that's what they call the death cross in markets. Now, we've had those before and it hasn't mattered. But the difference was back then, we just had a huge amount of QE that was flooding into the market. So again, we don't have that at the moment. And I'm not saying, and again, by the way, everything I'm saying right now is all negated at the moment the Fed comes back in and starts doing QE and drops rates back to zero. So that's the one caveat to all of this. Predictions are great, but as we talked about last week, is that there's a lot of things that can change this dynamic literally overnight. So unless the Fed comes back in and starts dropping rates back to zero or doing QE, the way this market will likely play out is a rally back to somewhere between the downtrend line, the 50-day moving average. And at that point, that's where the markets will be back to very overbought and we'll be looking to reduce risk. And then, of course, we'll have to see what happens after that.
Okay, great. Thanks. So we'll be watching that 50-day moving average very closely because that should be a very telling signpost whether it gets crossed or not. All right. So if you can tell us if you've made any trades in the portfolio based upon your outlook that you've just shared with us, love to hear what they are. I then have two other questions I want to get to with you. And one of them is going to be another sort of blood boiler like we had last week talking about stock buybacks. But okay. First, are there trades you're making right now?
We did a couple this week. We talked about last week that we had bought bonds and then we sold those last week. Yields are now back to around 2% and bonds are getting back towards oversold. So we're actually probably looking and we're not ready to pull that trigger just yet, but we're getting pretty close to the point that we'll probably add some of those bonds back into our portfolio just to kind of hedge some risk. Go ahead.
I just want to interject and give you credit. I don't think you intended to be this on the nose with your timing, but boy, you bought into those bonds right before interest rates started coming back down and you began to unload them right as they began going back up. So I'm sure you're probably nervous me doing this because not every pick of yours is going to play out exactly this well, but man, you just nailed it with this TLT trade.
You know what? A blind squirrel finds a nut every now and then, right? So here, the premise on bonds is simply this. And I was explaining this to a gentleman today. He's absolutely convinced we're going to have a recession. Okay. Now I'm not 100% convinced we have a recession, but there's a lot of reasons to believe we will be in a recession by the end of this year or next year. Economic growth is slowing. You've got high inflation, high oil prices, and you can just go right down the list. There's we got no liquidity coming into the markets. All the stuff we put into the markets is now coming out. Real wages are now negative. I mean, it just you know, it's there's a lot of problems economically that suggest we'll be in a recession.
There's so a parade. There's a parade of horribles. And I also just want to interject because you mentioned this to me right before we got on camera. Right. The bear market pattern that you talked about, that phase one, phase two, phase three, you said usually a phase three presages recession too, right?
Right. That's correct. Well, it precedes a recession then goes right into the recession, right?
Yeah.
And don't forget really what the bear market's telling you. And that's actually a great point, Adam. I'm glad you brought it up. If you wait for the National Bureau of Economic Research to tell you you're in a recession, you're 9 months too late every single time. So in other words, here's a good example of this. Let's go back to 2008. In 2007, Ben Bernanke said, don't worry, economy's fine, subprime is contained. We go through the entirety of 2008. And in December of 2008, the National Bureau of Economic Research tells you, says, oh, by the way, we were in a recession back in, you know, December of 2007. And by the way, we wrote an article in December of 2007. And in our newsletter in December of 2007, we said, we are either in or about to be in the worst recession we've seen since the Great Depression. And the National Bureau of Economic Research confirmed that a year later. So, you know, that is, the problem with that dating is that it's always behind the curve. And so it's of no help to you, respectively, in terms of managing your money. What the markets are telling you is that the economy is slowing down rapidly. Earnings are way too high. We just published an article on our website at Real Investment Advice talking about an earnings reversion is coming. Oil prices and economic crisis, those are all linked together historically. So we're going to have much slower rates of economic growth this year, much slower rate of earnings growth. That is going to impact the economy. And so the market's telling you right now that a recession is coming. It just hasn't been confirmed yet in the data, which is going to lag by 6 to 9 months. So having said that, these markets tend to be in a recession before the recession's announced. So by the time we get that third phase, we're going to be in the midst of the recession. And that's, everybody will be going like, what's going on? We're not even in a recession yet. Yeah, you are. It just hasn't been, we haven't revised the data to tell you that you're in a recession. So that's really the thing to pay attention to. Back to my guy that's convinced about the recession is he's long inflationary metals, he's long oil, he's long everything inflation. And I go, this is great. And I said, what happens when you have high inflation? He says, oh, we're going to have a recession. I go, great. What happens to commodities when you have a recession? Will they go down? Yes, because you have slower demand.
Demand
destruction. And so do you want to be long commodities when you get in a recession? He's like, no. I said, what do you want to be long when you get into a recession? Something that doesn't go down. What doesn't go down in recession? I'm having to lead him down this pathway, right? What doesn't go down in recession? Where does money hide in a recession? That's bonds.
How long did it take for him to get to long-dated U.S. Treasuries?
45 minutes. but we got there. And, you know, long-dated U.S. Treasuries, not corporates, not high yield. You don't want to be in those, but you want to be in long-dated U.S. Treasuries when you get into a recession, because your best return over the next 12 to 18 months will be in bonds over stocks.
All right. And that explains back to your trades, why right. You think you're going to start adding back to TLT again.
Correct. We're not quite there yet, but I think that probably in the next week or so, we'll probably be starting to nibble back in on our bonds.
Okay, great. All right. Well,
I'm sorry. I have one more trade this week.
Go for it.
So the other thing we did is we sold all of our Amazon position. Amazon announced that they were going to do a 20-for-1 stock split and a stock buyback of $10 billion. So we can get back in that whole argument about stock buybacks that we had last week. We think Amazon's a great company and long-term it's going to be, you know, will be something that we buy back. But, you know, when we're going into this environment, there's a real risk of a retail consumption recession, and that's Amazon, right? So we went ahead and sold the rest of our Amazon position, and we're going to reallocate those proceeds to some of our other technology stocks that we own, that we like, that have the ability to grow in a deflationary environment. So we'll probably be making those trades over the next week or so.
Okay. And I haven't followed this closely enough to really have an intelligent point of view to express on it, but I did see some headlines that Amazon is, I guess, the U.S. House of Representatives is opening up a criminal probe of Amazon right now, and I think it might be around antitrust issues. Mm-hmm. So this may be been a good time anyways to start lightening up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and look, all the big leaders in tech. So, you know, this is also important. You know, we manage a portfolio for long-term appreciation. So we're not trading, you know, all in and all out of positions. We'd sold down Amazon previously. We sold down Google, Apple, Microsoft, you know, those companies. We've sold them down to what we call a core position. There's a core holding that will, in companies that we like, that we want to own long-term, we have a base holding that we bring that down to, and then we'll hedge off that risk either by shorting the market or putting in, you know, alternative trades that work against those positions, et cetera. But, you know, for companies that we like, that we want to own long-term, it's rare that we'll sell them out entirely, but we've done more of that this year than we've done in the past three. So it just kind of tells you where we are in this environment. We've been selling the entirety of positions. We've reduced the number of holdings in our portfolio, total number of holdings, including our bonds. We're down to 24 holdings in total, and we're running about 33% cash right now in our portfolios because of where we are in this environment.
All right. And I think that's really something people who are listening to this really should pay attention to right here. You know, you're seeing a veteran money manager saying, I'm beginning to sort of, you know, reduce my holdings to a much lower level than I've had in the past number of years. My kind of core, you know, not going to sell holdings because of the concerns you have about where markets right. may be headed going forward from here. Right. And I see you nodding as I'm saying this, Lance. Yeah. Okay, great. All right. Well, two more topics I want to bang into with you. One is about commodity prices. They have continued to go higher in almost every case this year. You pick the commodity, it's you know, gold hit an intraday all-time high on Monday, I believe it was. Oil, you know, has been ping-ponging around, but last Sunday night, I think it got up to like $137 a barrel in the futures market. It's still, I think, around 110 or so right now. Two questions for you. One, as a money manager, are you contemplating any trades either for or against these commodities at these levels? Because things really did get changed here, right? Yeah. I mean, the U.S. and Russia, there's a lot of political posturing, but basically the U.S. said, look, we're not going to buy any more Russian commodities. And Russia turned around a few hours later and said, well, we're not going to sell any of them to you anymore anyways, for at least the next year. Russia is a big supplier of a lot of major currencies to the world. Could we be seeing kind of a persistent repricing of these core commodities? And if we are, then there's sort of all sorts of knock-on effects, right? Then that makes the inflation problem a lot thornier. You've got to make decisions around this. What are you thinking?
So a couple of things. I just full fair disclosure here is we don't trade futures because our clients don't understand. In a lot of cases, most people really don't understand how futures work. And in the money management business, it's not a transaction that a lot of people can understand and really grasp, and importantly, understand why things can go to zero in terms of a futures contract, right? So personally, I will trade futures and that's fine because I understand what I'm doing. But for clients, we just simply can't do that. So we play that market by buying, you know, stocks or investments, ETFs, whatever it is, that benefit from those movements. And, you know, so we were buying oil stocks in November of 2020, because remember, in November of 2020, everybody hated oil companies. And we said back then that oil companies, most hated asset on the planet, we're buying them because typically what happens is the most unloved asset becomes the most loved asset. Well, now we're just on the opposite side of that coin. We're actually starting we've been taking profits in our energy stocks as an example, just because they're so grossly overvalued at this point, so grossly extended. You're talking about, you know, positions that are 3 and 4 standard deviations above long-term means, and it's simply unsustainable. Here's the thing I want to say about the inflation trades. There's nothing wrong with them right now, and they are going up, and you should be long these plays. And we have a lot of positions in our portfolio, whether it's defense stocks or commodity-based, you know, type stocks, et cetera, to participate on this front. But we are what happened. Remember that there is a difference in commodities between what you see in terms of price and what happens really in the economy, because what you see in prices are the futures traders. These are the speculators. These are your big hedge funds, your big pension funds, you know, whatever. These commodity prices can get very extended during these kind of really bullish moves, because as prices go up, that gets more futures traders to buy more contracts, which, you know, pushes the prices even further. And we have these huge movements. And as we talked about last week, backwardation, for example, in oil is at the biggest level ever in history. We've never had a backwardation of front month contracts versus 12 month contracts like this ever. And this always corresponds to the peak of a recession at some point because of the impact that you're putting on the consumer. So here's my point about telling you this. It's great to be long this stuff. Don't forget to sell, because at some point there's going to be some guy on the commodity floor that goes, I'm out. And when he's out, prices are going to fall just as fast as they went up. You're going to wake up one morning, and we actually saw this earlier this week. Oil prices were down. ExxonMobil was down like 6% in a day, right? I mean, just the reversal was just like this. And you're going to wake up one morning and there's going to be some piece of good news in the Ukraine, or something's going to happen, and oil prices, wheat prices, et cetera, will all fall by 30, 40%. Literally, it'll seem like overnight. And this is not something that just I'm predicting. You go back and look at history, you see it every single time, right? It's just, you had the big run up in 2007 in oil prices going into the peak of 08. And then by the end of 08, they were back down to, you know, $30 a barrel. You know, that's the way these things occur, and they occur very quickly. So the point is, it's great to be long these trades. And I encourage you to be long these trades. It's a great way to hedge your portfolio against inflation right now. But don't forget to sell, because inflation will become deflation in what will seem like an overnight event.
All right, great. And that's really what I wanted people to hear here, which is, you know, look, a lot of people who have been watching this channel, I think, fall in the camp of people who have been sort of expecting a lot of what's going on right now, not necessarily the war in Ukraine, but excessive monetary policy to lead to higher inflation, right? And commodities have been so relatively undervalued to, you know, other financial assets for so long that there's this sense of like, finally, you know, our day in the sun is here, our moment's here, the new commodity super cycle has begun. And while all that may be true, you know, there is short-term risk along the way of that long-term journey, right? And I just want to make sure that they hear from, you know, professionals like you, seasoned professionals like you, strategies that they can use to, as you were saying earlier, hey, you know, eventually these are going to have their one of their top 10 bad down days when one of these corrections happens. So any steps you can take along the way to kind of minimize your vulnerability when that happens, you can keep a lot more of those gains along the journey.
Exactly. And one thing about, you know, I hear a lot of talk about commodity super cycles and these type of things. And there's certainly a case to be made for that. And if you go back to the 60s and 70s as a good example, and that was a good case of a commodity super cycle. And you have to remember the environment that we had back then. We had a strong manufacturing environment. We were producing everything. The U.S. was the epicenter of the entire world because we had literally bombed everybody else into oblivion. So we were rebuilding Europe, rebuilding Germany, rebuilding Japan. I mean, we were rebuilding all these. They couldn't manufacture. They had no manufacturing left. We were doing all the manufacturing here. So there was this huge demand for commodities for everything. Today, if you take a look at our economy, we're $30 trillion in debt. You're running an economy that's 80% services, 20% manufacturing. You know, our lives revolve around getting Uber Eats to deliver to our house rather than us going out and manufacturing stuff. You know, that's not the environment that gives you sustainable demand for a commodity super cycle long term. The problem that we face now, and again, it doesn't mean you can't have a commodity super cycle in other countries, but in the U.S., our problem is deflationary, depressionary structures because of demographic trends. There was a great chart out this morning just showing the working age, looking at a chart of the working age population. The growth rate over the last decade of the working age population is below, it's like 0.2%. It's the lowest rate of growth ever in the United States over the last 200 years. We're not producing babies. We have the lowest birth rate since the 1940s. We have a broken immigration system. Our immigration system right now is basically whoever wants to come here can come here. And that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. You know, we have an open, I live in Texas, right? So our big concern is this open border policy that we have. And we have a massive number of people immigrating into the state of Texas. And that's fine. They're low skill, low wage workers. The type of immigration that you need is you need to have an immigration program that incentivizes high capacity, high income earners, high skill sets to come into the country. So in other words, you set up an immigration system that says, look, if you bring capital into the country and you start a business and in 5 years you hire 20 American workers, we will give you your citizenship. That's your pathway to citizenship. If you come to America and you've got a master's degree, a PhD in science, math, you know, economics, whatever it is, and you go to work for a company and become a, you know, a contributing member of society that is, you know, producing, help growing the economy through manufacturing, whatever it is, you have a very fast pathway to citizenship. So in other words, it's a merit-based immigration system. I know a lot of people are against that, but when we take a look at the immigration problem relative to our demographics, what's our biggest problem going forward? Social Security is a $70 trillion unfunded liability. Back in the 40s, when you started Social Security, you had 16 people paying in for every one person drawing out. Now you have less than two people paying in for every person drawing out. What you need is more people in the country creating that are higher income wage earners or are creating businesses that hire more Americans to work for them that create more workers paying in to your social benefit pool. So if you're one of these people that want a lot of government social benefits, that's great, but you've got to have a way to pay for it and you need people producing. Remember, economic growth comes from production, not consumption. You've got to produce first in order to consume. And what we need is more producers to outweigh the number of consumers if you want to have a sustainable growth trend over time.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. You know, there's great comparison between the 50s and 60s versus now from sort of a global demand pull scenario. And look, don't get me wrong. I personally think commodities, lots of good reasons for them to have some sustained tailwinds going forward, but you got to be realistic, you know, about the macro situation. So I really appreciate that.
Well, and Adam, just real quick, you know, we are talking about timeframes, right? What my point is that, you know, and we could have inflationary pressures that last 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year, 18 months, you know, however it's going to last, however long it lasts. But when it ends, it's going to end very quickly. So just know that eventually this cycle ends and you get back because deflation will conquer inflation because of the function of demographics, debt, and the other functions of the economy.
Right. And folks, if you want to really get into the details of that, watch the video I recorded at Wealthion's recent conference with Lacey Hunt. I'll put up a link to it right here. Everything Lance just said, Lacey gives a 40-minute masterclass in all the reasons behind it, including more charts than you could ever believe. But it really is hard to hear Lacey and then not come away to say, you know what, I know people, you know, debate the whole inflation versus deflation, who's going to win. And it certainly seems like inflation's winning out right now. But after you see that, you really do understand the deflationary case. Yeah. All right. Well, so last thing I want to get into with you, and it does relate to commodities a little bit. I'm going to put up a chart here of nickel. And Lance, you're probably familiar with this. Folks who've been watching my other videos this week have already seen this chart too. But basically, the price of nickel just exploded earlier this week. And, you know, part of that was, I think, initially probably caused by all the same issues that are driving every other agricultural and mineral commodity and energy commodity up right now. But a unique factor here was there was a massive player who was short this market, who got sort of trapped in the mother of all short squeezes. And so nickel went up like over four times, almost five times in the span of like 48 hours. And the reason why I want to dig into this a little bit, Lance, is because the LBMA, the exchange that nickel was being traded on, basically shut down trading to stop the madness and canceled a number of trades. And in large part really seems to have done it to protect the interest of this very large player who is very politically connected, very, very rich. It's really hard for a lot of people. I mean, I think we can understand shutting down the exchange for a day, just like we have price circuit breakers in the markets if the markets move too fast too soon. But they've kept the exchange closed all week. As I mentioned, they've unwound a number of the trades or just denied a lot of the trades. So you had people that were acting based upon the market action and who many would argue, well, they took a risk and they should be compensated for it, who are not going to get paid. And it really does kind of look like they're doing this just to protect some really big rich dude. What do you think?
Are you surprised?
Well, I'm not a guy. As I said earlier, this is going to be a blood boiler, right? But this is sort of like a broad daylight, you know, example of how the rules apply to all the rest of us, but not to the big, rich, and politically connected.
Now, look, silver is one of the most manipulated markets on the planet. Gold is manipulated. There's been plenty of commentary in the past about gold markets and manipulation that goes on there. Commodity markets are notorious for manipulation. But to your point, two things happened that with nickel that I think are very endemic to what's going to happen with the rest of the market. First of all, the reason that to your comment about how fast nickel went up, this guy was short nickel and by a large amount, and he got margin called. And so when nickel triggered the margin call, that's when everything just broke in the markets. That's, and again, don't forget, we've got a very large amount of margin debt sitting on the stock market as well. So when margin call, this is the biggest risk for the Fed, right? We talk about financial instability. The biggest risk for the Fed is that this market falls to a point that banks go, yeah, you need to pay off your margin loan. And remember, margin debt is not the option of you. It's the option of the bank that loaned you the money. And it doesn't mean all banks call margin at the same time. And you don't have a choice. Either you come up with more capital or you liquidate your stocks. That's the risk to the financial markets. And that's the biggest risk to the Fed. And that's why they're so concerned about financial stability. That's why they keep showing up and doing QE every time markets dip enough. And at some point, you know, whether it's 15% or 20% or 25%, wherever it is, the Fed will be back. QE may be dead, but long live QE, because QE will be back sooner than later. But look, you know, we can go back to looking at, you know, do you remember the whole Melvin Capital issue on, you know, with what happened with Robinhood and the whole GameStop issue, right? They stopped trading on GameStop. Citadel wound up bailing out Melvin Capital. This has become run of the mill an environment for our financial markets. And it really is, you know, look, I've said this before, our major banks, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo in particular, Citigroup, JP Morgan, these guys are the mafia, and they run criminal enterprises on a variety of fronts. Wells Fargo is number one on my hit list as being a criminal enterprise. They have shafted their customers, opened fake accounts for them, all kinds of stuff. And yet they get a little slap on the wrist and says, oh, well, don't do that again. Then they turn right around and do it again. And nobody ever does anything about it. These major banks need to be broken up. These big prop desks need to be broken up. If you want to have a fair and free market environment where stocks actually, hey, imagine this, stocks reflect valuations, would that ever be an amazing thing? If you ever want that, you have got to demand legislation ultimately get passed that breaks up these major banks. They should, you know, back in the financial crisis, people argue with me over this all the time. But the worst thing we ever did in the financial crisis was bail out the banks. When Lehman went bankrupt, we should have allowed every one of those major banks to default at that time and be broken up. Because
you'll get no argument from me on this, buddy.
Well, here's what happens. Everybody goes, oh, we can't do that, right? We destroy the financial system. No. What would have happened is that if JP Morgan, as an example, was allowed to go bankrupt, then all the other midstream banks that are in all these other states would have absorbed the assets. They would have gotten the customers. FDIC could have stepped in, insured the deposits. That's all fine. But you would have had a much more diversified banking system rather than having five banks controlling 60% of the banking market. So until you were willing to give up, you know, this kind of idea of financialization and get back to some reality in the financial markets, this kind of action that you're seeing, this criminal enterprise that does exist, is going to continue to happen. And if you think you can play fairly in that in that environment with your, you know, $100,000 or your $1 million or whatever you got, you're cannon fodder for these banks. The banks are the ones that are selling you these products. You're the people they're offloading all their junk on so they can make money and ultimately cost you this stuff. So, and don't forget, when you talk about commodities trades and all this other stuff, you're going to be the last guy holding the bag, because Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, they're going to know this stuff is going to break before you do, and they will be out and they'll be selling you the product as they get out of it. Because remember, for every buyer, there has to be a seller. So always ask before you buy something, who is it that's actually selling to you?
Yeah.
Sorry. See, you got me all riled up again. Quit it.
Do you have another 3 hours? Yeah. This is a really important point, and I'm really glad that this is where the conversation's gone, because this is it's something I want to make sure people are aware of. And it's very enraging. And there's a lot of agency that we don't have in this story, right? The cartel that Lance is talking about is extremely entrenched. It's very powerful. It's highly politically connected. They work with the politicians to write all the regulations and whatnot. And kind of to your point, Lance, not only are they have superior information and they can act before the rest of us, but even if their plans go awry, well, they're going to get a bailout in the end, right? I say this not to make us mad, though we should be angry. And to absolutely to Lance's point, this is stuff that we as a populace should be demanding reform on. I'm not going to sell sunshine and say, hey, if every wealthy on writes the Congress, viewer writes their congressman, it's going to be solved tomorrow. But what I want people to realize is that this is going on, right? It's not a fair game. And it just means that there may be instances in where you have the right trade, but it actually goes against you or gets unwound or whatever, because the big boys rewrite the rules when, you know, things don't work out the way they want them to. So they force the destiny that they want on the markets. It's also a reason, I think, why working, you know, under an experienced financial advisor who sort of understands, you know, the street rules, and is a bit more savvy than the average investor who just doesn't, you know them, they can chart a course that you know, kind of knows where the bullies on the block are a little bit better, and hopefully help you navigate, you know, the street without getting mugged as badly. But anyways, I'm glad that you know, I didn't know when I asked the question if we were as lock-minded about this, but clearly we are.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's just, you know, I want you, like I said, you know, the most important thing to remember, and I just can't reiterate this, I tell this to people all the time, is look, as I said, for every buyer, there has to be a seller. You know, there's this myth of cash on the sidelines. There is no cash on the sidelines. Think about the market like a football game. I can have 50 people on the sidelines, but in the game, I can only have 11 players. And if I want somebody else on the field, I got to take one person out. The market's the same way. I can have $10, $50 trillion worth of cash, you know, over in buckets. That's fine. But in the market, there is only so much money, because for every buyer, there has to be a seller. And so whenever you're buying something, and this is, and Adam, this goes back to our conversation either last week or week before about doing one-sided trades. If you look at your portfolio and you go, man, I am 100% invested into inflation and I am killing it right now. You are. It's awesome. But you are on a one-sided bet on inflation. By the time you realize that train has changed tracks, it'll be too late. You're going to give up a huge amount of your gains. And again, whenever you're buying something, somebody else is selling it to you. So, you know, and to Adam's point, Wall Street has superior information. They've got superior speed. They have superior capital. They have superior connections, and they're the ones building the product. When you're buying a futures contract, they're the ones that are writing the contract you're buying. So they're taking the other side of the bet already when they write that futures contract. So, you know, you've got to understand where you fall into the chain, so to speak, of your investments. And don't think that you're just smarter than the average bear, because at the end of the day, this was GameStop, right? This was Reddit. And I wrote articles about this back in 2020, is that all these retail traders, but they're like, hey, man, we got Wall Street by the tail, man. We're going to kick their ass. And it sounded great. And at the end of the day, Wall Street ate their lunch. And that's going to happen here. So look at your portfolio and say, man, I am all one-sided. Maybe I better take a little bit of this money and just build a little bit of a hedge on a deflationary trade just in case. Because by doing that, yeah, this deflationary trade is going to lose money temporarily, but that's the whole point of a hedge. But when this side begins to deflate, and it will deflate very quickly, this side will start to inflate, and it'll give you time to rebalance your portfolio before you roll into panic mode and just start selling everything, right? So that's the whole point of hedging your portfolio, is to give yourself time to logically think through what's happening in the market. Is it a one day a week event? Is it a 1 week event? Or is this a change of trend that gives you time by hedging? And you know, too many times we get all on the one side of the thing. We get all kind of revved up because we're making all this money. And before you know it, go ask a GameStop trader. It can be gone really quick.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I hate to end it here, Lance. One of these days we're going to keep this thing to around 30 minutes, but geez.
No, we're not. Forget it.
Yeah, it's, I know. I know. Maybe we should just give that dream up. Anyways, people are very kind too. And they generally send me comments afterwards saying, hey, we like it long, so keep it long. All right. Well, look, folks, whatever happens next from here, Lance and I will be back on next week to do the next weekly market recap and digest it all for you. And if you, just a reminder, Lance and his firm, they're one of the firms that are endorsed, one of the financial advisory firms that are endorsed by Wealthion. We're huge proponents of, if you don't feel very confident right now how you're positioned, given all the macro risks that we talk about in this channel in general, but even the ones that Lance and I just talked about here, highly recommend that you sit down with your advisor. If you've got a good one, have them walk you through how you're allocated. If you don't have a good one, or if you want a second opinion by one that thinks of all the issues that we talk about on this program, just go to Wealthion.com and we can help set up a free, no strings attached, no commitment needed consultation with the firms that we endorse. Again, Lance and his firm being a principal among them. If you are enjoying these weekly market recaps, I think this was our 10th. I think this one's number 10, Lance. Yep. It's gone fast. It's great. But folks, if you've got to, if you like seeing them, help support them by hitting the like button and then clicking the red subscribe button below. And if you have any feedback about the series you want to offer, you know, whether it's just kudos, you really enjoy it, or whether it's ideas you want us to consider going forward, or whether you want us to wear different shirts or party hats, whatever, just let us know in the comments section below. Thanks so much again for coming on this week, Lance.
My pleasure. Thank you, Adam. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody. Thanks for watching.